Dr. Kenneth Hansen is the author of, I don't know, like a dozen books. Find him on Amazon. Always doing interesting work from his position as a professor of Judaic studies at the University of Central Florida and an old friend of the show. So good to hear your voice again, buddy.
So good to be with you. Good evening, good morning from the University of Central Florida, Orlando, Judaic Studies program.
The last time I saw you, what was the restaurant we were eating at? What was that place in Central at
Oh
in
my, that
Orlando
was
at the
a while
hotel?
ago. We have so many good restaurants here, don't
I
we?
know, but it was that like really good
Victoria
seafood
Pub.
restaurant in the hotel. I can't remember the name of the hotel, but that really elegant hotel downtown.
Oh yes, the Bohemian.
Oh, that's right. So anyway, love that night, and I'm so sorry that we lost touch along the way of me catching up with you with my PhD, but I still follow you, and I hope you heard me mention I've been asking about you forever, but I can't have you because you're on so regularly with
Is
George.
that right? Well,
Yeah,
I
that's
am
a good
still
thing.
here. I'm still around and delighted to be with you.
Okay, so I think about you all the time, not just because I continue to dabble in the field on which we overlap, and I continue to do work within the church. And I have a new book that I've been working on. It's already gone to, I haven't got my first pass on it yet, but it's going to press, should be out in February on Moses, from I'm working with a Israeli-born rabbi, a Pakistani-born Muslim scholar, and me, and we put together this book on the idea of Moses as a leadership model. So I
Oh
was really having to brush up on my Hebrew, and it was
yes.
killing me.
I can imagine.
It's
I can
killing me.
imagine. I've written about Moses myself. I
I
might
know.
have a slightly different angle because this guy can also be viewed as quite the tyrant. But
Yes.
yeah, maybe that's for another show.
Well, this is interesting because the book is actually about him as a leader and what was at stake in the desert, and so how it is that some people could see it that way. And we kind of address that issue because, in other ways, he's sort of the perfect model of servant leadership. And so there is there's that element too. So anyway, I want to say I'm so glad to hear that you remain an active voice here on Coast to Coast. And I thought it was very interesting when I heard that you were doing work on the possibility of a meteor explosion near the Qumran site that all but vaporized the ancient world. So I went to Amazon to find a book on that, and I didn't see a book on that. Do you have one out yet?
Not yet. Now,
Okay.
bear in mind, things change so quickly in the academic and the scholarly world. There was a paper, an academic paper, presented on this topic at the last international meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature, which I happen to have attended, presented my own paper there. I usually deal with the literature of the text, the ancient Hebrew, and so on, but to stumble across a paper being presented on this topic absolutely gravitated me, my
Right.
interest, my focus, and I became really enthralled. The idea that a meteor, an extraterrestrial visitor, let's say, came
Right.
and caused, wreaked havoc on an ancient Bronze Age civilization. And it's kind of appropriate that we're talking about this when we are, because with the storm Area 51 going on this weekend, here
Right.
we're talking about a real extraterrestrial visitation from a meteor that happens to coincide with a biblical text. This is phenomenal. It's
Well,
incredible.
but I've heard the same argument made for that it was a meteor which may have resulted in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and it is told as, fire and brimstone, but that it could have been an ancient meteor just as likely that coincided with the way that the text describes the elimination of those two towns based on their sinfulness.
Well, exactly. And the interesting thing is that in the academic world, I can certainly speak to that, there's this tendency to compartmentalize
Sure.
everything. And textual critics only talk about the text and
Right.
nothing else. They don't even go into the history of it. Is it possible that certain events actually took place in history? Well, we don't talk about that. And we're just interested in the text and themes and messages and the poetry and yada, yada. And I can tell you that most scholars put no real stock in the historicity of many of these, if not most of these biblical stories, including Sodom and Gomorrah. Their attitude is, well, this is just an ancient fable, and we just deal with texts, and we don't go beyond that. No one even stops to think, could something actually have happened in antiquity that was recorded by the biblical writers? That means there's a real core of history behind it. And now when we have scientific evidence that happens to coincide with the biblical narrative, and here's what was being elucidated, let's say, at that Society of Biblical Literature conference. And I have, in fact, the academic paper in front of me, which talks about a high heat, explosive Middle Gore event. And this is not Middle Earth, it's Middle Gore, which is a large circular plain that extends to the north of the Dead Sea. It's like a big circular disk, very fertile in ancient times, verdant, green. But something happened, stripping agricultural soils from once fertile fields. And what caused it? According to the science now, a superheated brine of the Dead Sea with anhydride salts that pushed over the landscape by this event's frontal shockwaves. Well, what event are we talking about? Most likely a massive meteor that literally exploded above the surface of the Earth, very much like the Tunguska explosion.
Right.
And how do we know this happened? Well, there's been archaeological digs in this area going on for years and years. And what has been uncovered are pottery shards. This is the whole basis of archaeology. I tell my students, I teach biblical archaeology here at the university, among other things. I say, you want to know what archaeology is? It's the study of pots.
Fragments.
Yes, pot fragments. Pot fragments are everything. Pottery sherds, we call them. And in this one site to the northeast of the Dead Sea called Tal el Hammam, what was uncovered were a mass of pottery sherds covered with what is explained as a frothy, melted surface with a glassy appearance that indicates that they were briefly exposed to temperatures well in excess of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the approximate heat of volcanic magma. Can you imagine?
Right.
This is not something we normally find in
No.
archaeological digs. I've dug myself in the Middle East, and we find sherds all over the place of pottery fragments. But some kind of meteoric aerial fireball literally exploded over the north end of the Dead Sea about 1700 BC, or before the Common Era, give or take 50 years, according now to radiocarbon dating of the ash that was produced.
Right.
My goodness.
You know, yeah. Okay. But this begs a question for me. So we look at the possibility of Sodom and Gomorrah having been wiped out from a meteor-like event of some sort, because we have it written into the text that something came raining down, and it was not a planet killer, but it was a city killer. You know, it was big enough to affect a large area, right? And then we also hear from, we can see in the biblical text something like, you know, maybe like the plagues, the 10 plagues, to go back to the Moses narrative, that may or may not be connected to volcanic activity on the island of Thera, which could have happened concurrently about that time, which could have resulted in a tsunami, which could have been part of the story of the wiping out of, you know, Pharaoh's army. And so we can see already, you know, there are some earthly or, you know, astronomical events that show up in both the narrative and the archaeology. Now, this is why I would argue for people who tell me that the Bible was written at a time when dinosaurs still roamed the earth, because I'm pretty certain that would rate a mention, right? That if there were T-Rexes rampaging through the Holy Land, that would have shown up somehow, right? But where does it in the Qumran, where in any of the other, you know, extra canonical, so after, you know, some period of time, where is there any written record from anybody or any source saying that there was a major explosion and then we could connect it to the area where the Dead Sea Scrolls had been found?
Genesis 19 is it. Now, I'm convinced, having studied this more in detail now, that this event actually gave rise to a whole ancient tradition that we call the apocalypse. Where did this idea of the apocalypse come from? That the world someday is going to end, and it's being reserved for fiery judgment and all these images of horror and hell in the future. Where did this come from? And how did this become a theme in later biblical literature, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, since Qumran, which is the location of this ancient sect, we call them the Essenes, who were most likely, in my opinion, the writers of these ancient scrolls.
Right.
Not far at all from where this happened. What separates them is time, of course, because we're talking about an event very early in the Bronze Age or Middle Bronze Age, about 1700 years before the Common Era. And literary records are very sparse, and such as they are, they're usually dismissed as mythology, including the Genesis account. Genesis 19, it says, the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah. Of course, I read it in the Hebrew as well. It talks about Gafrit Va'esh, which means literally sulfur and fire, or fire and brimstone, as it's often translated. And it says that God overthrew the cities in the entire plain. V'yahafoch is the word in Hebrew, literally turned upside down.
Right.
It's like a pancake being flipped. It was that violent, that cataclysmic, that catastrophic. And the Genesis text says it included all those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the land. And this is another amazing part of the archaeology, that not only do we have those basically vaporized shards of pottery, we have mud brick walls that just vanished. All that's left is just the foundation and
sure.
everything else gone. And also there are anhydride salts present throughout these strata, and there's every indication that the land itself was uninhabitable. This was a green, verdant area, which is hard to imagine, because if you know anything about the Dead Sea, this is the lowest spot on the earth. All around it is just empty sand. It's like a moonscape, barren, parched. Nothing lives there, just a few flocks of sheep and goats who feed
right.
on the sparse vegetation. That's it. But way back in antiquity, this was a green, verdant valley. Can
okay.
you imagine? And suddenly, it's completely overthrown, turned upside down, and that imagery stays on in the minds of ancient writers.
But I got to make sure I understand your timeline here, because if you're talking about the Essenes, who either wrote some, right? I mean, just to read your books, we know that they wrote a lot about their own people, and there was, they spoke about their leader, and there's a lot in there that would seem to be Essenian in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But then there's also some of the Pentateuch or some of the traditional Bible, like the Isaiah scroll, which is sort of word for word what we see, right, in other mm-hmm. in other biblical collections. So they either wrote it or they were caretaking for these texts, put them up there. But that's in the intertestamental period between roughly before the, you know, before AD and then what, 100 years after AD, that period? Or how far back do you think it goes?
That's right. Okay. Well, the scrolls themselves were written in the first 2 centuries before the Common Era. That's
right.
BCE or BC. And even though the sect lived into the first century, we're talking about the days of Jesus and John the Baptist and Herod and the Romans, it seems that very little, if any, of their material was actually written that late. It's most all in the first 2 centuries before the Common Era. But still, that is separated by centuries and centuries and centuries from when this cosmic air burst
has
taken place.
So that's what you're saying, is the cosmic air burst happened at the site which later we associate with the Dead Sea Scrolls of Qumran, but it didn't happen after the scroll that the Essenes had put the scrolls up and safeguarded them in those caves. It didn't happen after that. It happened sometime before that.
Way, way before.
Got it. Okay, fine. Now I understand.
We didn't know that such a thing had taken place even until the archaeology
discovered
the remnants of this. And then we put that together and with the narrative. The first thing you do in archaeology, you say, now we've got evidence. Do we have any narrative, any story in antiquity that might coincide with it? And again, that's the remarkable thing, because scholars so often tend to just dismiss ancient texts.
Right.
Mythology didn't have, for example, the whole story of the Trojan War was just laughed off as completely apocryphal, just nothing more than ancient folklore, until a renegade archaeologist named Heinrich Schliemann actually uncovered the city of Troy.
Right.
Whoops.
Right.
And we have something of that same magnitude going on here. It was just dismissed, this whole story of Abraham and, oh, come on, he's meeting God and two angels in his tent, and then these angels accompany him, and you've got Lot in the story who's told to leave the city. This is just folklore. That's all that it is. And now we've got this. Now, it doesn't prove all of the details of the story. Of course not. Any more than the city of Troy, now that we've got it, proves all the details of the Trojan War. But it sure speaks to something having gone on in that area. And since you mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's okay. At this point, I want to theorize that even though all we have is this story in Genesis of Abraham and Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah, that the memory of that apocalypse became ingrained in the psyche, as it were, even in the subconscious. And sure enough, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have some very spooky phraseology here. They wrote an entire book of psalms that are not in the Bible. Can you imagine?
Right.
A book of psalms that never made it into our Bible. These are the Dead Sea Psalms that mention all manner of topics, including the Messiah to come, which is not in the book of Psalms we're familiar with. So here's a passage from Dead Sea Psalm 5, which says this in English: "The torrents of Satan shall reach to all sides of the world. In their channels a consuming fire shall destroy every tree, green and barren, on their banks. Unto the end of their courses it shall scourge with flames of fire, shall consume the foundations of the earth and the expanse of the dry land. The bases of the mountains shall blaze, and the roots of the rock shall turn to torrents of pitch. It shall devour as far as the great abyss."
Not exactly Taylor Swift. Hang on to those lyrics, and stand by. Dr. Kenneth Hansen, you brought up several questions along the way about just that story, but we've got others to get to from past open line calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We were talking about psalms that were not included in the original canon of the Bible, but were associated with this group, the Essenes. There are lots of different writings that they have that are non-canonical. But I'll get back to one point, and then I want to go to something that somebody had brought up on Open Lines the other night. And I just think it was a compelling point. He's the perfect guy to address it coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Dr. Kenneth Hansen from the University of Central Florida, professor of Judaic Studies, I think about you from time to time. Not surprising, just because we're buds. But I mean, I think about you because we've had so many conversations over the years on Coast to Coast. And so when somebody brings up something from a biblical point of view, which they like to think of as the biblical point of view, I'm reminded of your work, and of course, you know, a shared philosophy about the multivocalness of the text, and that's what makes it so interesting. The complexity of the Bible text is what makes it so interesting.
Multivocalness,
right?
I love that.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a multivocal text. But I was thinking of you when somebody a couple of times it's come up, you know, that people treat the Bible as like it's supposed to be a book of science or a book of science history, like a history of our scientific understanding of the earth. And I don't think that's valid. I think what's more true, and I think this is the part that some people perhaps are less comfortable with, is it really the Bible is a book much more steeped in politics than science. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, yes. It is not only an ethical book, not only a religious text, but yeah, it's political. And the whole idea is to say, look, we are the Israelites. We were given a divine commission to inhabit this land, not any other land, only this land, the land of Israel and only the land of Israel. And this is ours. And we are obliged to keep it and to defend it. But then you get into all manner of political theory, even within that. I wrote a whole book on the political theory of the Hebrew Bible, because it seems that there's a real tug of war going on in ancient Israel that's not unlike what goes on in other societies, including the United States. What kind of government are we supposed to have? And what about the idea of a strong central state, a strong central government versus a diffuse kind of government among the people, among the various states, states' rights versus central government? There's the same thing going on in
right.
antiquity. Is it going to be Jerusalem that controls everything? Or what about the tribes out there
right.
in the hinterland? Who has authority? Who has power? So all these things come into play in this multivocal text. It's amazing.
Yeah. You know, I think the going back to the Moses story, too, I was interested, having spent a lot of time with it. And by the way, spending a lot of time comparing the biblical version versus the Quranic version of the Mosaic text. Have you read much of the Quran and seen the comparison that I'm talking about?
I am familiar to some degree with the Quran.
Well, in particular with Moses' text, because so much of it is the same. I mean, it's really they dovetail pretty nicely over each other, except there are little things where in the Quran where they seem to cut Moses a break that they don't in the biblical text. And so the Quran is less critical of Moses than ironically than the Judaic text, where he is a central figure, right, along with Abraham.
Exactly.
That part's kind of funny to me, that that in Islam that they kind of look at like, wow, the Bible's kind of harsh.
Well, Islam of course means submission. One submits unconditionally to Allah, to the will of Allah, and that's all well and good. But the difference is that in the Israelite culture, what became the Jewish culture, it's all about questioning. It's all about raising questions. It's about debating, arguing.
Right.
And that even comes into play with the great biblical heroes. Let's debate them.
Right.
Let's argue about them. And we, for that reason, see both a good side, a plus side of these characters, and also a downside. And that goes with Moses as well.
Right.
He had, for example, what amounts to a Praetorian guard around him in the Levites. And their job was to make sure that nobody criticizes Moses, and anybody who gets in Moses' way is going to come to an untimely end. And this happens. There are rebels who rise up against him, saying, "You're becoming a tyrant. We would have been better off in Egypt. What, you brought us out of tyranny just to give us a different tyranny under you?" And they are also dispatched. We're even told the ground opens up underneath the rebels and swallows them. This is brutal stuff. And yet the same individual is called the most humble man on earth.
Well,
like Moses.
I'm catching your attitude on Moses, which is good, and I'm grateful to hear it. But at the same time, God, you know, if we go with the text, the text says God says to do this. And or God says, "How dare they, your followers? I've already shown them. I've already demonstrated miracle after miracle. Why are they not respecting me? You better do something about this or I will." And so Moses is kind of caught in sort of a middle management position of like, okay, he doesn't want to see everybody he doesn't want to see the factory shut down, right? Doesn't want to see, and if it means firing some people in order to keep the factory open and the town running, well, then that's what he's going to have to do.
Yeah, middle management. I like that comparison. Yeah, exactly. Of course, that brings God into the picture. Is God really commanding Moses in all of these ways? That's something scholars debate. And of course, even in the Bible, it's possible to argue with God.
Right.
Abraham, whom we're talking about at Sodom and Gomorrah, argues with God. God
right.
says, "I'm going to destroy this city. I'm going to destroy everything in that plain." He doesn't realize a meteor is going to come down. And Abraham says, "Are you sure you want to do that?
Right.
what if I can find some righteous people?"
Right.
Really, you know, why doesn't Moses say that?
But he does kind of with the whole in the text where God says, "I'm going to wipe them all out. I'm going to start from zero." And he's like, and then there's the part where, you know, Moses again,
"Well, then destroy me."
Well, or he says, he brings up the Levites, and he says the Levites have to go in and destroy a portion of the children of Israel as an appeasement. And so, and not only that, but they have to destroy their own people from their own tribe just to show that they're not showing favorites. I mean, I'm not saying it's not violent as hell. It sure is. But it also sort of seems like if that's how close the margins were for this either working or not working, and if that's what it took, then it was better to shut down a division of the company than lose the entire company completely.
And it's also been pointed out that when we think of when this was happening and the circumstances surrounding this time of the Israelites in the desert, that it's almost like military tactics at
right.
this point. If we want to survive as a people, that's the middle management part,
right.
then we have to have this kind of order. And
all deserters will be shot.
Yeah, it's like in the military. Are all military commanders tyrants? Well, no, not at all. But when you are in battle, being attacked from all sides by Midianites and Amalekites and all these ites,
right.
then this is what has to happen. We have to have discipline and we have to have order. And that's what it took to take this ragtag group of malcontents out of Egypt and turn them into a fighting force, an army, as it were,
right.
that's capable in the next generation of taking this land that God had commissioned for them.
So, interesting. I know we could talk about that all night, but I will reflect back to how we start and say, this again is it that idea of, and I heard somebody once describe to me that Judaism is endlessly disputatious. It's a term I love. Yeah,
exactly.
And it is, and it
and
goes
it
on to this day.
Can't we have just one answer? No.
Right.
Everything is debatable. Maybe Moses was too harsh, but then again, maybe he wasn't. Maybe he had to do this, but maybe he heard from God. But why didn't he complain? And on and on.
But that carries over, and we sort of ignore it, or we Christians filter it out of the New Testament. But that model of that endlessly disputatious, that continues on into the arguing amongst the disciples with Jesus. And
absolutely.
And people draw halos around them, and they were all like a bunch of, they weren't. They were whining and complaining, and they were arguing, and it was just like the Old Testament.
Yeah, and one of my specialties in the Judaic Studies program, my scholarship, one of my scholarly specialties specifically involves Jesus and the New Testament from a Jewish standpoint.
Right.
So I deal with these texts all the time Judaically. And you're absolutely right, Ian. This is what we find. And Christians are sometimes puzzled by this.
Yeah.
And yet there it is, all through the Gospels and beyond, is this back and forth argumentation.
But is it any different than, as you point out, from the Old Testament when Jesus raises his, you know, face up to God and says, "Really? I really got to go through with this? No other plan here? Can't let this cup pass?"
Precisely. It's exactly
this hurts.
The kind of attitude that we get among the ancient patriarchs. Oh, really?
Right. And so that's what I find that very interesting. And I think
but
sometimes
one can argue with this God, and that is something that is specifically Western and specifically came out of the Jewish context. It's not so even in Islam, where one submits to God. No, in this context, one argues with God. That's essential. It's vital. It's part and parcel of what became the Western mindset, Western culture, in fact. Because we have this running dialogue even with God, therefore, it's up to us not just to enter into that dialogue, but to actually make the world a better place. It's on our shoulders. That's the end point of this argumentation. We see things that are wrong in the world, and we've got to improve them. We've got to make them better. That is so Jewish, and it's
right.
so Western, and it's so Jesus also.
You know, I'll diverge a little bit from your point on that, only to say this. I think what's interesting about working with Islamic scholars is that they would say there is very little about the Bible, both Old and New Testament for them. There's very little that with which they disagree, and that they are, as Muhammad instructed, they are to read the Bible, they are to accept that word of God that exists in the Old and the New Testament, only up to the point where it disagrees completely with Islam. And I'm not sure that the idea of submission stands in direct opposition to disputation. Because I think even in the Quranic narrative, it doesn't mean that everybody's a robot. It just means that they don't argue as much, perhaps, although there is still arguments that go on in the text. And there's arguments about what does Allah want from us. But I think what they would disagree, and they would say, well, we're right up with, you know, they love the, I was reading one of the 16th century summations of the Bible from a Muslim scholar. You probably know Kathir, and that he quotes Matthew, he quotes Luke. I mean, they quote them, and in doing so, they're good with the whole Jesus thing right up until Jesus is up to the divinity of Jesus, and that's where they disagree. But up until that point, they accept everything about, you know, the origin stories.
Jesus
and
accepted as a prophet, and you're absolutely right. Up to the point that it would disagree with or contradict the basic tenets of Islam. And Islam is sternly monotheistic.
Right.
We think of Judaism as monotheistic, Islam extremely monotheistic. There can't even be any kind of representation of a human being that might perhaps be worshipped. No images,
right,
for example, are permitted of Muhammad. And as far as Jesus, it's exactly on point. His divinity cannot be accepted in Islam, but of course he's a great prophet, just as Abraham, just as Moses.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, and this again, circling back to the idea of the Bible as a political book, it has a lot more to say about the conflict that we have between our conservative impulses and our liberal impulses, between justice and mercy, and that they both exist within the Old Testament text. And they're always kind of in in conflict with each other, and we're still trying to resolve how much justice and how much mercy, what's appropriate for when and in what proportion.
Well, I'm teaching a whole course right now at the University of Central Florida this semester called Social Justice and the Prophets. And one of the key ideas is that when the great Israelite prophets came along, they basically reinvented the whole idea of God in the Israelite context.
Right.
Because when you look at some of these early narratives, going back to Moses, for example, and Joshua and the conquest narrative, you find a deity who is pretty harsh, as we've been talking about. And yet the prophets come along and they reimagine a God of infinite mercy and compassion. Isaiah, my goodness, Amos, incredible social justice warriors, these guys.
Right.
And where did that come from? It's a whole new way to look at God, and it feeds ultimately into what became the Jesus movement. Mercy, compassion. I desire mercy, says God, not sacrifice.
And I think a lot of people are unaware of how much polytheism is still evident in the Old Testament text. We kind of screen it out in a way, but the idea of he's the God of gods already implies that there are other lesser gods, and that there's all this talk about God's jealousy about worshiping other gods because they're not as good as me. I'm the best God. And so this kind of polytheism exists there that doesn't really exist in Islam. It doesn't exist in Christianity, really, except for the complication of the whole Trinity thing. And the idea of what was considered a deity, and these other tribes had their own deity. It's just that, you know, the Israelites were there to demonstrate that God was better than that. God was the best God of all of them.
Yeah, well, we know that the Israelites, even from the archaeology, had many other pagan deities beside their own. And this is something also that the prophets were trying to eradicate. There's got to be only one God, but that flies in the face that people were still worshiping others side by side. And the pagans do arguably get a bum rap in the Bible. Were they really all as nasty as they were made out to be? Not necessarily. In fact, in many ways, they were very tolerant. You worship your God, I worship my goddess. Can't we all just get along? Not in Israel, you can't.
Well, and so as we come up to the top of the hour, I wanted to then grab one other topic from you. And we'll get to calls for Ken Hansen coming up a little bit later on. But there's a lot of discussion about, we had it early in the first hour, we were talking about CBD oil. We were talking about alternative medicines. And there's some people that just say, well, you know, we're playing God anytime that we start to mess around with things, and that even, you know, modern medicine plays God when it does this or that. And I can't help but think that some people aren't aware that there were a lot of, you know, well, at least I'll ask you about, and I'll just have you pause on it for now. We'll get to it coming up next. Hallucinogenics in the Bible, painkilling in the Bible, those things which many people claim, well, you know, that's in the Bible. You know, that idea that, you know, that marijuana was in the Bible. People were getting stoned back in the Bible. So I want to ask you, Dr. Ken Hansen, then, to address specifically those types of things which people throw around so easily as being biblical, were they? And we'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet.